Back in Genesis chapter 32, Jacob is on the run from his brother. His brother wants to kill him. They come to a river called the Jabbok River. Jacob, at that point, has a couple of wives. He has 11 sons. When they get to the Jabbok, he tells his sons to go on the other side with his wives. He will spend the night on this side. No sooner has the family gone across the fords of the river when Jacob has hunkered down when a man comes out of nowhere and jumps him. They engage in a fight. They wrestle. The word there literally means to get down and dirty. So this is not an argument. This is something like a fist fight. It's a wrestling match. They go down to the ground and then they go back up again. And this goes on, we guess, for an hour or two. You imagine how exhausting it would be to wrestle somebody for a couple of hours who is better than you. After a couple of hours, this messenger, angel, or God himself realizes that while Jacob will never win the fight, he won't lose it either. And so he touches Jacob's hip. And when he does, he throws it out of socket. Jacob falls to the ground. When he fell, he must have grabbed the man and pulled him on top of himself. Because after wrestling a little bit longer, the man says to Jacob, "Let me go." Jacob says, "Not until you bless me." The man says, "What is your name?" He says, "Jacob," which means deceiver. Man says, "Not anymore. Tonight, your name is changed. It's no longer Jacob. You're no longer a deceiver. Your name is Israel," which means he wrestles with God. He fights with God. For the man says, "You have wrestled with God and overcome." Jacob says, "What's your name?" The man says, "Why do you ask my name?" And vanishes. Jacob, now still on the ground, rolling around, trying to soothe that hip, trying to gather himself, notices that the sun is slowly beginning to rise. They've been at it all night. And as it rises, Jacob realizes what has happened. And he renames the place where they fought. He calls it Peniel, which means face of God. For he says, "It is here that I have wrestled with God. I have seen the face of God." And I lived. I begin with the story because it's so typical of many conversion experiences. Some of us in the room, not all of us, maybe not even most of us, but some of us in the room have had our own night at the Jabbok, where out of nowhere it seems God came upon us in the form of a fight. We didn't expect it. You never see it coming. Sometimes it's unfair. It's always undeserved. But suddenly you find yourself in the middle of a fight, not only with others, but with God. But if we can stay in that fight without leaving him, something happens. He changes us. We are converted. We are no longer deceiver. We are now one who wrestles with God. We are one who has seen the face of God. That seems to be the pattern of every conversion. It's always unexpected. It often arises from a struggle. After the struggle, there is a moment of release. We are touched, and after that, our identity is changed. Nothing in our life is the same from that moment on. Now, I say this because I think, as I said, there are some in the room that have had your night with God. I have more than one. And that's where I want to go. I think in the church, we have conflated conversion with getting saved. And I don't think it's the same thing. When Christians talk about crusades, they always want to know how many got converted. But conversion doesn't mean surrender. It means to change. It means to pivot, to go in another direction. So whenever you're asking who was converted, you're not asking who repeated a prayer, who was baptized, or who took the sacrament for the first time, who made a public profession. That's not conversion. That's a profession. A conversion is the actual substantive change that comes about after that. And that's pretty important, because there are some who had that night with God. They have repeated a prayer. They have come to an altar. They have taken communion, and they have considered themselves converted as a result of that. But since that was their conversion, it's like nothing more is needed. Only it is. Others of us, this includes me right now, I think it's some of you who grew up in the church. I can never remember a day when I wasn't saved. There were moments that seemed important to me, but I can't tell you everything changed in that night, because, I mean, I grew up in a religious home. So I don't know how to speak of becoming a Christian, because when you grow up religious, it feels like you always were. Are you there? So I think what is needed is a way to speak about being converted without making us seem like we're lost. So I am this year seeking another conversion. And I want one for you, even if you've never had one. I want there to be a defining moment in your life where out of nowhere, God just jumps you. And you get into this struggle with God. And even though you can't win it, you say, I will not lose. And in the middle of that struggle, God touches you and he changes something in you. And as a result of that, you walk different for the rest of your life. Your identity has been changed. I think there's precedence for this in the Gospels. If I go into the story of the disciples, the ones who decided to follow Jesus, there's this moment in Luke chapter 22. It's actually Jesus' last night as a free person. The next day he will be betrayed, and then they will take him and crucify him. He's been with them now for 3 years. He's got the disciples with him around the table, which we call the Last Supper. At the table in Luke 22, he says to his disciples, you are my disciples, and I confer unto you a kingdom like the one my Father conferred unto me. So you will eat at my table, and you will rise up to judge the tribes of Israel. This is as good as it gets. Then, a moment later, he turns to Peter at the table and says, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you like wheat. But I've prayed for you that your faith will not fail. Now listen, and after you're converted, strengthen the brothers. So you don't miss it. This is not said at the beginning of Peter's spiritual life. It's said 3 years into his spiritual life. If you were to ask me when Peter was converted, in the evangelical sense, I would have said, oh, on the day he was called. But here at the end of 3 years, he learns he is not converted yet. The same thing is true in Matthew chapter 18. The disciples are gathered around having an argument about which of them is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Peter is no doubt part of this argument. In the midst of this argument, now more than 2.5 years into his ministry, Jesus takes a child, stands the child in the midst of the disciples while they're bantering over who is greatest in the kingdom of heaven and says to them, unless you are converted and become like this child, you won't even enter the kingdom of heaven. So again, we have disciples who thought they were converted are not converted yet, more than 2.5 years after they decided to follow Jesus. You see the problem. The moment we make converted getting saved, it's like we lose the rest of our spiritual life after that. Two scenes. One is Peter in Luke chapter 5, and the other scene is at the end of his life. In Luke chapter 5, Peter's out in his boat. Jesus walks by the sea, sees Peter, and gets into Peter's boat. Just helps himself. He tells Peter to push off from the shore so he can turn and speak to the people. Jesus turns, stands up in the boat, addresses the people on the shore, and then after he's through speaking, he turns and says to Peter, now push out, go out into the deep and drop your nets and get you some fish. Peter is a fisherman. This is what he does. He says, Lord, we've been doing this all night and we haven't caught anything. But you say so. So he pushes out into the deep. They drop the net, and no sooner do they drop the nets when they feel that familiar drag on the net. They start pulling the nets into the boat, and there are hundreds of fish, such that the boat starts to sink. There's so many fish. Peter, now overcome by this moment, falls to his knees in the boat and says to Jesus, go away from me, I'm a sinful man. So here we have a man who is fairly self-absorbed, just in order to play along, patronize Jesus, we'll go put the nets down. But he's pretty much the same guy. The end of Peter's life is not in the Bible, but there are historical records that report what he reported. Peter has moved to Rome. Nero is the emperor. He has declared the death of all Christians. Peter hears this. He decides to leave Rome and spare his life. He gets on the Via Appia, or the Appian Way. The road is still there to this day. You can walk it. He starts walking outside of the city to run for his life. And he says he saw the risen Christ coming in the other direction. He says to him, Kovadi, Lord, where are you going? And Jesus allegedly says, I'm going to Rome to be crucified again. In that moment, Peter knows that that will be the end. Jesus is not speaking of himself. He is speaking of Peter. You remember at the end of John chapter 21, he said, the day is coming when someone will lead you by the hand to places you don't want to go. Peter knows that this is that moment. He turns around. He goes back into Rome. He is arrested and he is convicted. They're ready to kill him by crucifixion. He asks one last favor, that he be crucified upside down, because in his words, he is not worthy to die like his Lord. And so he is tied, not nailed, to a cross. The cross is inverted and put into its position. Peter dies upside down. Why do I tell this story? Because it's radically different than the guy in the boat 30 years ago. If we want to speak about conversion, we have to speak about the length of a person's life, the whole thing, not just a single incident where something is different. People move in and out of changes all the time. We have to compare their life over years, not moments. Now I am speaking of us. When you look back at the moment when you first decided to become a Christian, what in your life is substantially different today than was true when you first started? There should be some visible evidence that our lives are slowly changing. I think there isn't just one conversion. There's a series of conversions all along the way. And every one of these have the same characteristics. They're almost all unexpected. We start with a wrestle with God. Something inside of us changes and we begin to live differently. I don't think that happens once. I think it happens again and again and again. This is true of Peter. When Peter walks on water, he's not just defying gravity. Something inside of him is changing. When Peter stands in Caesarea Philippi and says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," in Matthew chapter 16, he's not just making a declaration of faith. Something has happened to that guy. When Peter goes up the Mount of Transfiguration and he sees Jesus completely transfigured, the word literally means in the Greek, peeled back. He sees the humanity of Jesus peeled back. And he stares into his divinity. I think it rattled him. And he's never the same again. He will never pray the same. He will never talk to Jesus the same after that day. I think that was a moment as radical as the first one. When Peter denies him for the third time, "I swear to God, I don't know this guy." Is not what he was saying. I think he was saying, "I swear to God, that's not the guy I thought he was. Messiahs are not walked out with their hands tied behind their back. Messiahs don't get crucified. That's not the guy I was following." I think it's a pivotal moment. After the third denial, the rooster crows. He hears it. He turns, and it says Jesus stared at him. And he went out into the night and wept bitterly. I think that was a pivotal moment. Hours earlier, he had said, "I'll die for you." Now he learns that he's not the man he thought he was. He's way overestimated his faith. And now it's clear to everybody, including him, that's a pivotal moment. Are you tracking? There's this, yes? There's a series of these moments that go through his life, and they're critical to me because these are the same kinds of moments that I think we need in ours. We need to shift our trust from self to God until we step out of the boat. We need to watch the stakes go up to see what messiahs really do and double down and say, I'm still in. We need to have our vision of Christ transfigured. We need a moment where we see ourselves as we truly are. These moments change us, everyone. There is none more foundational, I think, than the first one in Matthew 4. Peter's out in the boat, 100 yards off ashore. Jesus comes walking by the sea, sees Peter, sees his brother in the boat, and he shouts out to him, come and follow me, and I will turn you into fishermen who catch people. So the Bible says they drop everything instantly. They row to shore, they get out of the boat, and they start to follow him. So much of his future is wrapped up in those four verses in Matthew chapter 4. And as I look at it, so much seems different from what sounds like evangelism today. For starters, the word follow me means to come alongside. It doesn't mean to get behind him like he's a tour guide. It's a combination of two words in Greek. One means a road or a path, and the other means in union with. And so the statement, the call to follow me, is a call to get in step with Jesus and start walking along the path. And as you walk along, we are talking not about his life. Jesus had his life, and his life on earth is now over. What remains is your life. And so the point in following him is never just to imitate Jesus, but to interpret what Jesus would do in your job and your situation, because that is what disciples are always talking about. How would Jesus do my job if he had it? Peter is not asking for the forgiveness of sins. He's not asking to go to heaven. He's not trying to be a Christian. We can't load onto this moment stuff that isn't there. He is simply curious about who this guy is. And it turns out the first conversion is a change in curiosity. It's a change of interest. In the stuff you think about and you care about, you can't figure out. I wonder if we need to restore a sense of curiosity about Jesus, especially among Christians. Are you there? Because we have him figured out. Jesus is both more liberal than you, and more conservative than you. In matters of finance, he's more liberal. He gives it all away. In matters of sexuality, he's more conservative. He says, if you even lust, in matters of enemies, he calls for us not only to forgive, but to bless and to pray for. Not because he wants us to be nice people. That's your mother. It's because he knows something about your enemies that you don't know. And if you knew what he knew about money, you'd handle it differently. If you knew what he knew about enemies, you would treat them differently. If you knew what he knew about humanity, you would be more hospitable. If you knew what he knew about marriage, you would be more sanctified in your vows. I think there's room among religious people to ask a lot of questions about who this character is. Because he says some truly outrageous things, which if you haven't been numbed to them, having heard them so much, I know that. Which means I've heard that. They're shocking. So I suggest maybe we get into small circles with other Christians. Start there. And maybe we start asking questions like, what did Jesus say that irritates you? Annoys you, because it sounds ludicrous. And it would be far better to just say it, bold-faced, than to pretend that nothing shocks us anymore. It would be good to gather around the question, what does Jesus do effortlessly and routinely? And why is that so easy for him? And it's not for me. To gather around the question, not what would Jesus do, we know that. Why would he do it? Why does anybody think the way he thinks? Where did he learn this? Far better for us to wrestle than simply comply. Sunday school taught me how to obey, but at the same time, it stifled my curiosity. This is a call for the curious to come alive in you again. When Peter follows Jesus, it is out of curiosity. There is nothing in that call that I can tell he is following for his own sake. It is more that he is taken up with Jesus than he is taken up with himself and trying to bring Jesus into his life. It's not what he's doing. He's simply leaving his life in order to follow Jesus. And that, I think, is a different direction. And that call is always outward. Well, I don't suggest that you and I ever lose our curiosity. I suggest what happens is other things come up alongside that curiosity. Good things, noble things, jobs, families, projects, degrees. They are all good things, but they grow up alongside this curiosity for Jesus. And you can't. In my yard, every now and then, well, first, I hate gardening. It's a pain. But I've noticed a tendency, you guys, among the weeds that are in our yard. Some of them, they all have a different way to survive. Some are just prickly and basically says, you touch me, I'll hurt you. But there's others, the way that they survive is they grow up alongside the thing it wants to overtake, and they send off a flower that looks exactly like the flower. Are you tracking? And the longer this goes, the two start to intertwine until you truly cannot tell what is weed and what is flower. This is what I think happens to our interest and our curiosity for Jesus Christ. I don't think we ever surrender it. I just think other things come along. Noble things, good things that grow up right next to it until we can no longer distinguish the pursuit of Jesus from every other pursuit. They look exactly the same until we think when we are doing those other things, we are pursuing Jesus. They are that similar. I don't think they're always the same. I think we can go years without being curious again. So my challenge for you this morning is that you examine, after we leave, the things that have grown up around and then after into your pursuit of Jesus that is slowly siphoning the energy off. This is the first step, not the last. John Wesley has written a prayer that helps us put language to this. It's a prayer that helps us say we will serve God, follow God, pursue God, no matter what happens to us. We've got the words to that prayer, and I just think the most appropriate way for us to be sent this morning is not with anything that I say, but something we say together. Would you join me by standing, looking to the screen? And church, with sincerity and humility, self-examination, let this be our prayer. Here we go. I am no longer my own, but thine. Put me to what thou wilt. Rank me with whom thou wilt. Put me to doing. Put me to suffering. Let me be employed by thee or laid aside for thee, exalted for thee, brought low for thee. Let me be full. Let me be empty. Let me have all things. Let me have nothing. I freely, heartily yield all things to thy pleasure and disposal. And now, O glorious and blessed God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, thou art mine, and I am thine. So be it. And the covenant which I've made on earth, let this be ratified in heaven forever.